The woman? Apgar almost laughed. Who the hell knows? The guns and the oil were connected. But how? It didn't feel like Dunk. Holding a city hostage was out of his league, and the army now had enough weaponry to take the isthmus and put him out of business. It would be a slaughter on both sides. The causeway was a kill box. But once the dust settled, Dunk Withers would find himself either lying dead in a ditch with 50 holes in him, or swinging from a rope. So suppose, Peter thought, the oil wasn't just a play. Suppose it was actually for something. What do we know about this boat of his? He asked. Apgar frowned. Not a lot. Nobody from the outside has laid eyes on the damn thing in years. But it's big. So folks say. You think that's got something to do with it? I don't know what to think. But there's something we're missing. Have we spread that ammo around? Not yet. It's still in the armory. Get it done. And let's send a patrol to scout the isthmus. How long till we hear from Freeport? A couple of hours. It was a little after 3 p.m. Let's get men on the perimeter. Tell them it's a training exercise. And get some engineers on the gate. The thing hasn't been closed in a decade. Apgar gave him a look of caution. Folks will notice that. Better safe than sorry. None of this makes sense to us, but it does to someone. What about the isthmus? We don't want to wait too long to get a plan in place. I won't. Write it up. Apgar rose. I'll get it on your desk within the hour. That quick? There's only one way in. Not a lot to say. He turned at the door. This is completely fucked, I know. But maybe it's the opportunity we've been waiting for. That's a way of looking at it. I'm just glad it isn't Chase sitting in that chair. He left Peter alone. Just 5 minutes, and the piles of paper on his desk now seemed completely trivial. He swiveled his chair to face the window. The day had begun with clear skies, but now the weather was turning. Low clouds hovered over the city, a heavy gray mass. A gust of wind tossed the treetops, followed by a flash whitening the sky. As thunder rolled behind it, the first drops of rain, heavy and slow, tapped the glass. Michael, he thought, what the hell are you up to? 43. Anthony Carter, 12th of 12, had just shut off the mower when he looked toward the patio and noticed that the tea had arrived. So soon? Could it be noon again already? He angled his chin to the sky, an oppressive summer Houston sky, pale like something bleached. He removed his hanky and then his hat to mop the sweat from his forehead. A glass of tea would surely hit the spot. Mrs. Wood. She knew that. Though, of course, it wasn't Mrs. Wood who brought it. Carter couldn't say just who it was. The same someone who delivered the flats of flowers and bags of mulch to the gate, who fixed his tools when they broke, who made time turn how it did in this place. Every day a season, every season a year. He pushed his mower to the shed, wiped it clean, and made his way to the patio. Amy was working in the dirt on the far side of the lawn. There was some ginger there. It grew like crazy, always needing cutting back, bordered by the beds where Mrs. Wood liked to put some summer color. Today it was three flats of cosmos, the pink ones that Miss Haley loved, picking them and putting them in her hair. "Tea's here," Carter said. Amy looked up. She was wearing a kerchief around her neck. There was dirt on her hands and face where she'd wiped the sweat away. You go ahead. She batted a gnat from her face. I want to get these in first. Carter sat and sipped the tea. Perfect, as always. Sweet, but not too sweet. And the ice made a pleasant tinkling against the sides of the glass. From behind him, in the house, came the bright, drifting notes of the girls playing. Sometimes it was Barbies or dress-ups. Sometimes they watched TV. Carter heard the same movies playing over and over. Shrek was one, and The Princess Bride. And he felt sorry for the two of them, Miss Haley and her sister, all alone and stuck inside the house, waiting for their mama to come home. But when Carter peeked in the windows, there was never anybody there. The inside and the outside were two different places, and the rooms were empty. Not even any furniture to tell that people lived there. He'd had some time to think on that. He'd thought about a lot of things, such as what this place exactly was. The best he could come up with was that it was a kind of waiting room, like at a doctor's office. You bided your time, maybe flipping through a magazine, and then when your turn came, a voice would call your name and you'd go on to the next place, whatever that was. Amy called the garden the world behind the world. And that seemed right to Carter. How the day got on, he thought. He'd have to get back to work soon. There was a sprinkler head needed replacing, and the pool to skim, and all that edging to do. He liked to keep the yard just so for the day when Mrs. Wood would return. "Mr. Carter, what a beautiful job you've done taking care of the place. You're a godsend. I don't know what I ever did without you." He liked to think of the things they'd say to each other when that day came. The two of them would have a good talk, just like they used to, sitting on the patio the way any two friends would do. But for the moment, Carter was content to settle in a spell while the edge came off the heat. He unlaced his boots and closed his eyes. The garden was a place for thinking your thoughts, and that was what he did now. He remembered Walgast coming to him in Terrell, which was the death house, and then a ride in a van with deep cold and snowy mountains all around, and then the doctors giving him a shot. It made him sick, something awful, but that wasn't the worst of it. The worst was the voices in his head. "I am Babcock. I am Morrison. I am Chavez, Baffus, Terrell, Winston, Sosa, Eccles, Lambright, Martinez, Reinhardt." He saw pictures, too. Horrible things. People dying and such, like he was dreaming someone else's dreams. He'd been to school for a bit, and they'd read a book by Mr. William Shakespeare. Carter hadn't actually read much of it himself. The words in the book were like something chopped up in a blender, that's how confusing it was. But the teacher, Mrs. Coe, a pretty white lady who decorated the walls of her classroom with posters of animals and mountain climbers and sayings like, "Reach for the stars," and "Be a friend to make a friend," had showed the class a video. Carter liked it. How everybody was always getting in sword fights and dressed like a pirate, and Mrs. Coe explained that the main guy, who was named Hamlet and was also a prince, was going crazy because somebody had killed his daddy by pouring poison in his ear. There was more to the story, but Carter remembered that part, because that's what the voices reminded him of. Like poison poured in his ear. Things had gone on like that for a while. Carter wasn't sure how long. The others were whispering away, saying various things, ugly things. But mostly what they said was their names, over and over, like they couldn't get enough of themselves. Then they fell quiet, like the air before a storm, and that was when Carter heard him. "Zero." Heard wasn't exactly the word. Zero could make you think with his own mind. Zero came into his head, and it was like taking a step that wasn't there and tumbling down a lightless hole, and at the bottom of the hole was a train station. Folks were hurrying in winter coats, and the voice over the loudspeaker was calling out the numbers of the tracks and what was going where. New Haven, Larchmont, Katona, New Rochelle. Carter didn't know those places. It was cold. The floor was slick with melted snow. He was standing at the kiosk, the one with the four-faced clock. He was waiting for someone. Someone important. One train arrived, and then another. Where was she? Had something happened? Why hadn't she called? Why did she fail to answer? Train after train, the anticipation intense. Then, as the last passengers hurried by, the cruelest dashing of his hopes. His heart was shattering, yet he couldn't make himself move. The hands of the clock mocked him with their turning. She said she would be here. Where was she? How he longed to hold her in his arms. Liz, you are the only thing that ever mattered. Let me be the one to hold you as you slip away. After that, Carter had gone plain crazy. It was like one long, bad dream in which he was watching himself do the worst kinds of things and couldn't stop. Eating folks. Tearing them to bits. Some he didn't kill but only tasted. No rhyme or reason to it. It was just a thing he did because that's what Zero wanted. He remembered a couple in a car. They were driving somewhere in a hurry, and Carter had come down on them from the trees. Leave those people be, he was telling himself. What they ever done to you? But the hungry part of him paid this no mind. It did what it liked, and what it liked was killing folks. He landed hard on the hood and gave them a good long look at him, his teeth and claws and what he was about to do. The two of them were young. There was the man at the wheel and the woman beside him who Carter guessed was his wife. She had short blonde hair and eyes that were wide and staring. The car began to fishtail. They were sliding all over the place. The man was yelling, "Holy shit," and "What the fuck?" But the woman barely reacted. Her eyes slid right through Carter, her face as blank as paper. Like the sight of a monster on the hood was nothing her brain knew what to do with. And it stopped Carter flat. That's how weird it was, and that was when he noticed the gun. A big, shiny pistol with a barrel you could fit your finger in, which the man was trying to aim over the steering wheel. Now don't be pointing that, the one part of him, the still Carter part, was thinking. You don't ever point a gun at no one, Anthony. And maybe it was the memory of his mama's voice, or else the way the car was swerving in long, looping arcs like a kid on a swing, pumping higher and higher and faster and faster. But for a second, Carter froze. And as the car began to roll, the gun went off in a blast of noise and light, and Carter felt a sharp little sting in his shoulder. Not much more than a bee might do. And the next thing Carter knew, he was rolling on the pavement. He came up in time to see the car banging down on its side. It spun in a 360 and crashed down onto its roof with an explosion of glass and a shriek of tearing metal. It began to roll down the asphalt like a log, over and over, bright bits of things hurling away, until it flopped one last time onto its roof and came at last to rest. Everything was very still. They were deep in the country, miles from any town. Debris littered the roadway in a wide, glittering plume. He smelled gasoline and something hot and sharp, like melted plastic. He knew he should feel something, but didn't know what. His thoughts were all mixed up inside him like single frames from a movie he couldn't put in order. He scuttled his way to the car and crouched to look. The two of them were hanging upside down from their seatbelts, the dashboard crunched up against their waists. The man was dead, on account of the big piece of metal in his head. but the woman was alive. She was staring forward, wide-eyed, blood all over her. Her face and shirt, her hands and hair, her lips and tongue and teeth. Black smoke was coiling from under the dash. A piece of glass crunched under Carter's foot, and her face swiveled toward him, slowly. No other part of her moving, tracing the source of the sound.
Is somebody there?
Bubbles of blood formed at her lips as they curved around the words.
Please, is anybody there?
She was looking right at him. That was when Carter realized she couldn't see. The woman was blind. With a soft whoomp, the first flames appeared, licking under the dash.
Oh, God, she moaned. I can hear you breathing. For the love of God, please answer me.
Something was happening to him. Something strange. Like the woman's sightless eyes were a mirror, and what he saw in them was himself. Not the monster they'd made him into, but the man he used to be. As if he were waking up and remembering who he was. He tried to answer.
I'm here, he wanted to say. You're not alone. I'm sorry about what I done.
But his mouth would not make words. The flames were spreading, the cabin filling with smoke.
Oh, God, I'm burning, please. Oh, God, oh, God.
The woman was reaching for him. Not for him, he realized. To him. Something was clutched in her hand. A hard spasm shook her. She had begun to choke on the blood that was pouring from her mouth. Her fingers opened, and the object fell to the ground. It was a pacifier. The baby was in the back seat, still strapped in its carrier upside down. Any second, the car was going to blow. Carter dropped to the ground and slithered through the back window. The baby was awake and crying now. The carrier would never fit. He'd have to take the baby out of it. He released the buckle, guided the child's shoulders through the straps. And just like that, the soft, crying weight of a baby filled his arms. A little girl, wearing pink pajamas. Holding her tight to his chest, Carter wriggled free of the car and began to run. But that was all he remembered. The story ended there. He never did know what became of that baby girl. For Anthony Carter, 12th of 12, made it all of 3 steps before the flames found what they were looking for. The gas in the tank ignited, and that car was blown to smithereens. He never took another one. Oh, he ate. Rats, possums, raccoons, now and again a dog, which he always felt sorry about. But it wasn't long before the world went quiet, and there weren't so many people around to tempt him. And then one day, after more time had passed, he realized there weren't any people at all. He'd closed himself to 02, closed it to all of them. Carter wanted no part in what they were about. He built a wall in his mind, 0 and the others on one side and him on the other. And though the wall was thin and Carter could hear them if he chose to, he never sent anything back. It was a lonely time. He watched his city drown. He'd made a place for himself in that building, one Allen Center, on account of it was high, and at night he could stand on the rooftop among the stars and feel close to them for company. Year by year, the waters rose around the bases of the buildings. And then one night, a great wind came barreling down. Carter had been through a hurricane or two in his day, but this wasn't like any storm he'd ever seen. It set the skyscraper swaying like a drunk. Walls were cracking, windows popping from their frames. Everything was in an uproar. He wondered if the end of the world was coming, if God had just grown sick and tired of it all. As the waters rose and the building rocked and the heavens howled, he took to praying, telling God to take him if that's what he wanted, saying he was sorry over and over about the things he'd done, and if there was a better place to go to, he knew he didn't deserve it any but hoped he'd get a chance to see it, assuming God could forgive him, which Carter didn't think he could. Then he heard a sound, a terrifying, heart-rending, inhuman sound, as if the gates of hell had opened and released a million screaming souls into the whirlwind. From out of the blackness a great dark shape emerged. It grew and grew, and then the lightning flashed, and Carter saw what it was, though he could not believe it. A ship. In downtown Houston. She was headed straight for him, her great keel dragging along the street, bearing down upon the towers of the Allen Center like God's own bowling ball, and the buildings were the pins. Carter dropped to the floor and covered his head, bracing for the impact. Nothing happened. Suddenly, everything went quiet. Even the wind had stopped. He wondered how this could be so. The sky so furious one minute and still the next. He rose and peered out the window. Above him, the clouds had opened like a porthole. The eye, Carter thought. That's what this was. He was in the eye of the storm. He looked down. The ship had come to rest against the side of the tower, parked like a cab at the curb. He climbed down the face of the building. How much time he had before the storm returned, Carter couldn't say. All he knew was that the ship being there felt like a message. At length he found himself in the bowels of the vessel, its maze of passages and pipes. Yet he did not feel lost. It was as if an unseen influence was guiding his every action. Oily seawater sloshed around his feet. He chose a direction, then another, drawn by this mysterious presence. A door appeared at the end of the corridor, heavy steel, like the door of a bank vault. T1, it was marked. Tank number one. The water will protect you, Anthony. He started. Who was speaking to him? The voice seemed to come from everywhere. From the air he breathed, the water sloshing at his feet, the metal of the ship. It enfolded him like a blanket of perfect softness. He cannot find you here. Abide here in safety, and she will come to you. That was when he felt her. Amy. Not dark like the others. Her soul was made of light. A great sob racked his body. His loneliness was leaving him. It lifted from his spirit like a veil, and what lay behind it was a sorrow of a different kind. A beautiful, holy kind of sorrow for the world and all its woes. He was holding the wheel. Slowly it turned under his hands. Outside, beyond the walls of the ship, the wind was howling again. The rain lashed, the sky rolled, the seas tore through the streets of the drowned city. Come inside, Anthony. The door opened. Carter stepped through. His body was in the ship, the Chevron Mariner. But Carter was in that place no more. He was falling and falling and falling. And when the falling stopped, he knew just where he was, even before he opened his eyes, because he could smell the flowers. Carter realized he'd finished his tea. Amy was done with the cosmos and was tidying up the beds. Carter thought to tell her to rest a spell. He'd get to the weeds directly. But he knew that she'd refuse. When there was work to do, she did it. The waiting was hard for her. Not just because of the things she'd have to face, but for what she'd given up. She never said a word about it. That wasn't Amy's way. But Carter could tell. He knew what it was like to love a person and lose them in this life. Because Zero would come calling. That was a fact. Carter knew that man, knew he wouldn't rest until the whole world was a mirror to his grief. Thing was, Carter couldn't help but feel a little sorry for him. Carter had been in that station himself. Weren't the question the man had wrong? It was his way of asking it. Carter got up from his chair, put on his hat, and went to where Amy was kneeling in the dirt. "Have a good nap?" she asked, looking up. "Was I sleeping?" She tossed a weed onto the pile. "You should have heard yourself snoring." Now that was news to Carter. Although, come to think of it, he might have rested his eyes there for a second. Amy rocked back on her heels and held her arms wide over the newly planted beds. "What do you think?" He stepped back to look. Everything was neat as a pin. "Those cosmos is pretty. Mrs. Wood will like 'em. Miss Haley, too. They'll need water. I'll see to it. You should get out of the sun for a bit. Tea's still there, you want it." He was hooking the hose to the spigot near the gate when he heard the soft pressure of tires on asphalt and saw the Denali coming down the street. It halted at the corner, then crept forward. Carter could just make out the shape of Mrs. Wood's face through the darkly tinted windows. The car cruised slowly by the house, barely moving but never stopping either, the way a ghost might do, then accelerated and sped away. Amy appeared beside him. "I heard the girls playing earlier." She, too, was looking down the street, though the Denali was long gone. "I brought you this." Amy was holding a wand. For a second, Carter was unable to connect the idea of it to anything else. But it was for the cosmos, of course. "Are you okay?" she asked. Carter responded with a shrug. He threaded the wand to the end of the hose and opened the spigot. Amy returned to the patio while Carter dragged the hose to the beds and began to water them down. It hardly mattered, he knew. Autumn would be here soon. The leaves would pale and fall. The garden fade. The wind grow raw. Frost would wick the tips of the grass, and the body of Mrs. Wood would rise. All things found their ends. But still, Carter went on with it, passing his wand over the flowers back and forth, back and forth, his heart always believing that even the smallest things could make a difference. 44. All day long, the rain poured down. Everyone was antsy, trapped in the house. Caleb could tell that Pim's patience with her sister was wearing thin, and he felt a row coming. A few days ago, he might have welcomed such a development, if only to get it over with. Dusk was near when the clouds broke. A radiant sun streamed low across the fields, everything sopping and glinting in the light. Caleb scanned the ground around the house for ants. Finding none, he declared that they could go out to enjoy the last of the day. All that remained of the mounds were ovals of depressed mud barely distinguishable from the surrounding earth. "Relax," he told himself. "You're letting the isolation get to you, that's all." Kate and Pim supervised the children making mud pies while Caleb went to check on the horses. He'd built an open-sided shelter on the far side of the paddock to give them cover from the weather. And that was where he found them now. Handsome seemed none the worse for wear, but Jeb was breathing hard and showing the whites of his eyes. He was also holding his left rear hoof off the ground. The horse let him bend the joint long enough for Caleb to see a small puncture wound in the raised central structure of the hoof. Something long and sharp was stuck in there. He walked to the shed and returned with a halter, needle-nosed pliers, and a rope. He was fixing Jeb's halter when he saw Kate coming his way.
He doesn't look so happy. Got a pricker in his hoof. Could you use an extra set of hands?
He was fine on his own, but the woman's sudden interest in helping out wasn't anything he was going to say no to. The ropes should hold him. Just keep a hand on his halter. Kate gripped the leather near the horse's mouth.
He looks sick. Should he be breathing like that?
Caleb was crouched at the rear of the animal. You're the doctor, you tell me. He lifted the horse's foot. With his other hand, he angled the pliers to the wound. There wasn't much to grab hold of. As the tips made contact, the animal shoved his weight backward, whinnying and tossing his head.
Keep him still, damn it! I'm trying.
He's a horse, Kate. Show him who's boss.
What do you want me to do, slug him?
Jeb was having none of it. Caleb left the shelter and returned with a length of 3/4-inch chain, which he ran through the halter, up and over the horse's nose. He tightened the chain against Jeb's jaw and gave the ends to Kate. Hold this, he said, and don't be nice. Jeb didn't like it, but the chain worked. Caught in the tips of the pliers, the offending article slowly emerged. Caleb held it up in the light. About 2 inches long, it was made of a rigid, nearly translucent material, like the bone of a bird.
Some kind of thorn, I guess, he said.
The horse had relaxed somewhat, but was still breathing rapidly. Flecks of spittle hung from the corners of his mouth. His neck and flanks were glossed with sweat. Caleb washed the hoof with water from a bucket and poured iodine into the wound. Handsome was lingering near the shelter, watching them cautiously. While Kate held the halter, Caleb sheathed the hoof in a leather sock and secured it with twine. There wasn't much else he could do at this point. He'd leave the animal tied up for the night and see how he was in the morning. Thanks for your help. The two of them were standing at the door of the shed. The light was just about gone.
Look, Kate said finally, I know I haven't been especially good company these days.
It's fine, forget it. Everybody understands.
You don't need to be nice about it, Caleb. We've known each other too long.
Caleb said nothing.
Bill was an asshole. Okay, I get that.
Kate, we don't have to do this.
She didn't seem angry, merely resigned. I'm just saying I know what everybody thinks, and they're not wrong.
People don't even know the half of it, actually.
So why did you marry him?
Caleb was surprised at himself. The question had just popped out. Sorry, that was a little direct.
No, it's a fair question. Believe me, I've asked it myself.
A moment passed, then she brightened a little.
Did you know that when Pim and I were kids, we used to have fights over who would get to marry you? I'm talking physical fights. Slapping, hair pulling, the whole thing.
You're kidding.
Don't look so happy. I'm surprised one of us didn't end up in the hospital. One time, I stole her diary. I think I was 13. God, I was such a little shit. There was all this stuff in there about you. How good-looking you were, how smart you were. Both your names with a big fat heart drawn around them. It was just disgusting.
Caleb found the thought hilarious.
What happened?
What do you think?
She was older. The fights weren't exactly fair.
Kate shook her head and laughed.
Look at you. You love this.
It was true. He did.
It's a funny story. I never knew about any of it.
And don't flatter yourself, Bub. I'm not about to throw myself at your feet. He smiled.
That's a relief.
Plus, it would seem a little incestuous. She shuddered.
Seriously. Gross.
Night had fallen over the fields. Caleb realized what he'd been missing. The feeling of Kate's friendship. As kids, they'd been as close as any two siblings. But then life had happened. The army, Kate's medical training, Bill and Pim, Theo and the girls, and all their plans. And they'd mislaid each other in the shuffle. Years had passed since they'd really spoken, the way they were doing now. But I didn't answer your question, did I? Why I married Bill? The answer is pretty simple. I married him because I loved him. I can't think of a single good reason why I did. But a person doesn't get to pick. He was a sweet, happy, worthless man. And he was mine. She stopped and said, I didn't come out here to help you with the horses, you know. You didn't? I came to ask you what's making you so nervous. I don't think Pim has noticed, but she's going to. Caleb felt caught. It's probably nothing. I know you, Caleb. It's not nothing. And I have my girls to think about. Are we in trouble? He didn't want to answer, but Kate had him dead to rights. I'm not sure. We might be. A loud whinny in the paddock broke his thoughts. They heard a crash, then a series of hard, rhythmic bangs. What the hell is that? Kate said. Caleb grabbed a lantern from the shed and raced across the paddock. Jeb lay on his side, his head tossing violently. His hind hooves were knocking against the wall of the shelter in spasmodic jerks. What's wrong with him? Kate said. The animal was dying, his bowels released, then his bladder. A trio of convulsions barreled through his body, followed by a final, violent tremor, every part of him stiffening. He held this position for several seconds, as if stretched on wires. Then the air went out of him, and he was still. Caleb crouched beside the carcass, lifting the lantern over the animal's face. A bubbly froth, tinged with blood, was running from his mouth. One dark eye stared upward, shining with reflected light. Caleb, why are you holding a gun? He looked down. So he was. It was George's revolver, the big .357, which he'd hidden in the shed. He must have grabbed it when he'd retrieved the lantern, an action so automatic as to escape his conscious awareness. He'd cocked the hammer, too. You need to tell me what's going on, Kate said. Caleb released the hammer and swiveled on his heels toward the house. The windows shimmered with candlelight. Pim would be making supper, the girls playing on the floor or looking at books, baby Theo fussing in his high chair. Maybe not. Maybe the boy was already asleep. He sometimes did that, passing out cold at dinner time only to awaken hours later, howling with hunger. Answer me, Caleb. He rose, slipped the pistol into the waistband of his trousers and drew his shirt over the butt to conceal it. Hansom was standing at the edge of the light, his head bent low like a mourner's. The poor guy, Caleb thought. It was as if he knew that the job would fall to him to drag the carcass of his only friend across the field to a patch of useless ground, where come morning, Caleb would use the rest of his fuel to burn it. 45. By late afternoon, Eustace and Fry had canvassed most of the outermost farms. Overturned furniture, beds disturbed, pistols and rifles lying where they'd fallen, a round or two fired, if that. And not a living soul. It was after 6 o'clock when they finished checking the last one, a dump of a place 4 miles downriver, near the old ADM ethanol plant. The house was tiny, just one room, the structure hammered together from scrap lumber and decaying asphalt shingles. Eustace didn't know who'd lived out here. He guessed he never would. Eustace's bad leg was aching hard. They'd have just enough time to make it back to town before dark. They mounted their horses and turned north. But 100 yards later, Eustace held up. Let's have a peek at that factory. Fry was leaning over the pommel. We ain't got but 2 hands of light, Gordo. You want to go back without something to show for it? You heard those folks. Fry thought for a moment.
Let's be quick on it.
They rode into the compound. The plant comprised three long two-story buildings arranged in a U, with a fourth, much larger than the others, closing the square. A windowless concrete bulk connected to the grain bins by a maze of pipes and chutes. The skeletal husks of rusted vehicles and other machinery filled the spaces between the weeds. The air had stilled and cooled. Birds were flitting through the glassless windows of the buildings. The three small structures were just shells, their roofs long collapsed. But the fourth was mostly tight. This was the one Eustace was interested in. If you were going to hide a couple hundred people, that would be a place to do it. You gotta wind up in your saddlebag, don't you? Eustace asked. Fry retrieved the lantern. Eustace turned the crank until the bulb began to glow.
Thing won't last more than about 3 minutes, Fry warned.
You think they're in there?
Eustace was checking his gun. He closed the cylinder and reholstered the weapon, but left the strap off. Fry did the same.
Guess we're going to find out. One of the loading dock doors stood partially open. They dropped and rolled through. The smell hit them like a slap.
I guess that answers that, Eustace said.
Fuck me, that's nasty.
Fry was pinching his nose.
Do we really need to look?
Get a hold of yourself.
Seriously, I think I'm gonna puke.
Eustace gave the lantern a few more cranks. A hallway lined with lockers ran to the main workspace of the building. The smell grew more intense with every step. Eustace had seen some bad things in his day, but he was pretty sure this was going to be the worst. They came to the end of the hallway, and a pair of swinging doors.
I'm thinking this might be the time to ask about a raise, Fry whispered.
Eustace drew his pistol. Ready?
Are you fucking kidding me?
They pushed through. Several things hit Eustace's senses in close order. The first thing was the stench, a miasma of rot so gaggingly awful that Eustace would have lost his lunch on the spot if he'd actually bothered to eat. To this was added a sound, a dense vibrato that stroked the air like the humming of an engine. In the center of the room was a large, dark mass. Its edges appeared to be moving. As Eustace stepped forward, flies exploded from the corpses. They were dogs. As he raised his pistol, he heard Fry yell, but that was as far as he got before a heavy weight crashed into him from above and knocked him to the floor.
All those people gone.
He should have seen this coming. He tried to crawl away, but something awful was occurring inside him. A kind of swirling. So this was how it was going to be. He reached for his gun to shoot himself, but his holster was empty, of course. And then his hands went numb and watery, followed by the rest of him. Eustace was plunging. The swirling was a whirlpool in his head, and he was being sucked down into it. Down and down and down.
Nina, Simon, my beloveds, I promise I will never forget you.
But that was exactly what happened. 5. The Manifest. We must take the current when it serves, or lose our ventures. Shakespeare. Julius Caesar. 46. It was nearly 9 o'clock when Sister Peg walked Sarah out.
Thank you for coming, the old woman said. It always means so much.
116 children, from the tiniest babies to young adolescents. It had taken Sarah 2 full days to examine them all. The orphanage was a duty she could have let go of long ago. Certainly Sister Peg would have understood. Yet Sarah had never been able to bring herself to do this. When a child got sick in the night, or was down with a fever,
or had leapt from a swing and landed wrong. It was Sarah who answered the call. Sister Peg always greeted her with a smile that said she hadn't doubted for a second who would be gracing her door. How would the world get on without us? Sarah figured that Sister Peg had to be 80 by now. How the old woman continued to manage the place, its barely contained chaos, was a miracle. She had softened somewhat with the years. She spoke sentimentally of the children, both those in her care and the ones who had moved on. She kept track of their lives, how they made their ways in the world, and whom they married, and their children, if they had them, the way any mother would do. Though Sarah knew the woman would never say as much, they were her family. No less than Hollis and Kate and Pym were Sarah's. They belonged to Sister Peg, and she to them. "It's no trouble, sister. I'm glad to do it." "What do you hear from Kate?" Sister Peg was one of the few people who knew the story. "Nothing so far, but I didn't expect to. The mail is so slow." That was a hard thing with Bill. But Kate will know what to do. She always seems to. "Would it be all right if I worried about you?" "I'll be fine, really." "I know you will. But I'm going to worry anyway." They said their goodbyes. Sarah made her way home through darkened streets. No lights burned anywhere. It had something to do with the supply of fuel for the generators. A minor hiccup at the refinery. That was the official word. She found Hollis dozing in his reading chair, a kerosene lantern burning on the table, and a book of intimidating thickness resting on his belly. The house, where they had lived for the past 10 years, had been abandoned in the first wave of settlement, a small wooden bungalow practically falling down. Hollis had spent 2 years restoring it, in his off hours from the library, which he was now in charge of. Who would have thought it? This bear of a man passing his days pushing a cart through the dusty shelves and reading to children. Yet that was what he loved. She hung her jacket in the closet and went to the kitchen to warm some water for tea. The stove was still hot. Hollis always left it that way for her. She waited for the kettle to boil, then poured the water through the strainer filled with herbs she'd taken from the canisters that stood in a neat line on the shelf above the sink, each one marked in Hollis's hand. Lemon balm, spearmint, rose hips, and so on. It was a librarian's habit, Hollis said, to fetishize the smallest details. Left to herself, Sarah would have had to spend 30 minutes looking for everything. Hollis stirred as she entered the living room. He rubbed his eyes and smiled groggily.
"What time is it?"
Sarah was sitting at the table.
"I don't know. 10? Guess I fell asleep there.
The water's hot. I can make you some tea." They always drank tea together at the end of the day. "No, I'll get it." He lumbered into the kitchen and returned with a steaming mug, which he placed on the table. Rather than sit, he moved behind her, took her shoulders in his hands, and began, with gathering pressure, to work his thumbs into the muscles. Sarah let her head slump forward.
"Oh, that's good," she moaned.
He kneaded her neck for another minute, then cupped her shoulders and moved them in a circular motion, unleashing a series of pops and cracks.
"Ouch!" "Just relax," Hollis said. "God, you're tight." "You would be, too, if you just gave physicals to 100 kids.
So tell me, how is the old witch?"
"Hollis, don't be nasty. The woman's a saint. I hope I've got half her energy at her age. Oh, right there."
He continued his pleasurable business. Bit by bit, the tensions of the day drained away.
"I can do you next if you want," Sarah said.
"Now you're talking." She felt suddenly guilty. She tipped her face backward to look at him.
"I have been ignoring you a little, haven't I?"
"Comes with the territory."
"Getting old, you mean?"
"You look pretty good to me."
"Hollis,
were grandparents. My hair's practically white. My hands look like beef jerky. I won't lie. It depresses me.
You talk too much. Lean forward again. She dropped her head to the table and nestled it into her arms.
Sarah and Hollis, she sighed. That old married couple. Who knew we'd be those people someday?
They drank their tea, undressed, and got into bed. Usually there were noises at night. People talking in the street, a barking dog, the various small sounds of life. But with the power out, everything was very quiet. It was true. It had been a while. A month? Or was it two? But the old rhythm, the muscle memory of marriage, was still there, waiting.
I've been thinking, Sarah said after.
Hollis was nestled behind her, wrapping her in his arms. Two spoons in a drawer, they called it. I thought you might be.
I miss them. I'm sorry. It's just not the same. I thought I'd be okay with it, but I'm just not.
I miss them, too. She rolled to face him. Would you really mind so much? Be honest.
Well, that depends. Do you think they need a librarian in the townships?
We can find out.
But they need doctors. And I need you.
What about the hospital?
Let Jenny run it. She's ready.
Sarah, you do nothing but complain about Jenny.
Sarah was taken aback.
I do?
Non-stop.
She wondered if this was true.
Well, somebody can take over. We can just go for a visit to start, to see how it feels. Get the lay of the land.
They may not actually want us out there, you know, Hollis said.
Maybe not. But if it seems right, and everyone's agreed, we can put in for a homestead, or build something in town. I could open an office there. Hell, you've got enough books right here to start a library of your own.
Hollis frowned dubiously. All of us crammed into that tiny house.
So we'll sleep outside. I don't care. There are kids.
He took a long breath. Sarah knew what Hollis was going to say. It was just a matter of hearing him say it.
So when do you want to leave?
That's the thing, she said, and kissed him.
I was thinking tomorrow.
Lucius Greer was standing under the spotlights at the base of the dry dock, watching a distant figure swinging over the side of the ship in a bosun's chair.
For God's sakes, Lor yelled, who did this fucking weld?
Greer sighed. In 6 hours, Lor had seen very little that she actually approved of. She lowered the chair to the dock and stepped free.
I need half a dozen guys down here now. Not the same jokers who did these welds, either.
She angled her face upward.
Weir, are you up there?
The man's face appeared at the rail.
String up 3 more chairs, and go get Rand. I want these seams redone by sunrise.
Laura looked at Greer from the corner of her eye.
Don't say it. I ran that refinery for 15 years. I know what I'm doing.
You won't hear any complaints from me. That's why Michael wanted you here.
Because I'm a hard ass.
Your words, not mine. She stood back, hands resting on her hips, eyes distractedly scanning the hull.
So tell me something, she said.
All right.
Did you ever think it was all bullshit?
He liked Lore, her directness.
Never. Not once?
I wouldn't say the thought never crossed my mind. Doubt is human nature. It's what we do with it that matters. I'm an old man. I don't have time to second-guess things.
That's an interesting philosophy.
A pair of ropes drifted down the flank of the Bergensfjord, then 2 more.
You know, Laura said, all these years, I wondered if Michael would ever find the right woman and settle down. Never in my wildest dreams did I imagine my competition was 20,000 tons of steel.
Rand appeared at the gunwale.
He and Weir began to hitch up the bosun's chairs.
"Do you still need me here?" Greer asked.
"No, go sleep."
She waved up at Rand. "Hang on, I'm coming up." Greer left the dock, got in his truck, and drove down the causeway. The pain had gotten bad. He wouldn't be able to hide it much longer. Sometimes it was cold, like being stabbed by a sword of ice. Other times it was hot, like glowing embers tossing around inside him. He could hardly keep anything down. When he actually managed to take a piss, it looked like an arterial bleed. There was always a bad taste in his mouth, sour and urea-ic. He'd told himself a lot of stories over the last few months, but there was really only one ending he could see. Near the end of the causeway, the road narrowed, hemmed in on either side by the sea. A dozen men armed with rifles were stationed at this bottleneck. As Greer drew alongside, Patch stepped from the cab of the tanker and came over. "Anything going on out there?" Greer asked. The man was sucking at something in his teeth. "Looks like the army sent a patrol. We saw lights to the west just after sundown, but nothing since."
"You want more men out here?"
Patch shrugged.
"I think we're okay for tonight. They're just sniffing us out at this point."
He focused on Greer's face.
"You okay? You don't look too good."
"Just need to get off my feet."
"Well, the cab of the tanker is yours if you want it. Catch a few winks. Like I said, there's nothing going on out here."
"I've got some other things to see to. Maybe I'll come back later."
"We'll be here."
Greer turned the truck around and drove away. Once he was out of sight, he pulled to the side of the causeway, got out, placed a hand against the fender for balance, and threw up onto the gravel. There wasn't much to come up, just water and some yolky-looking blobs. For a couple of minutes he remained in that position. When he decided there was nothing more, he retrieved his canteen from the cab, rinsed his mouth, poured some water into his palm, and splashed his face.
The aloneness of it. That was the worst part. Not so much the pain as carrying the pain.
He wondered what would happen. Would the world dissolve around him, receding like a dream until he had no memory of it? Or would it be the opposite? All the things and people of his life rising up before him in vivid benediction until, like a man gazing into the sun on a too bright day, he was forced to look away. He tipped his face to the sky. The stars were subdued, veiled by a moist sea air that made them seem to waver. He brought his thoughts to bear upon a single star, as he had learned to do, and closed his eyes.
"Amy, can you hear me?"
Silence. Then,
"Yes, Lucius."
"Amy, I'm sorry, but I think that I am dying."
47. A spring afternoon. Peter was working in the garden. Rain had worked through in the night, but now the sky was clear. Stripped to his shirt sleeves, he jabbed his hoe into the soft dirt. Months of eating from the canning jars while they watched the snow fall. How good it would be, he thought, to have fresh vegetables again.
"I brought you something."
Amy had snuck up behind him. Smiling, she held out a glass of water. Peter took it and sipped. It was ice cold against his teeth.
"Why don't you come inside? It's getting late."
So it was. The house lay long in shadow, the last rays of light peeking over the ridge.
"There's a lot to be done," he said. "There always is. You can get back to work tomorrow."
They ate their supper on the sofa, the old dog nosing around their feet. While Amy washed up, Peter set a fire. The wood caught with crackling quickness. The rich contentment of a certain hour. Beneath the heavy blanket, they watched the flames leap up.
"Would you like me to read to you?"
Peter said he thought that would be nice. Amy left him briefly and returned with a thick, brittle volume. Settling back on the sofa, she opened the book, cleared her throat, and began. David Copperfield by Charles Dickens.